Hello, my name is Dr. Jim Doty, and I'm the host of the Into the Magic Shop podcast, where we explore the mysteries of the brain and the secrets of the heart. Hi, this is Dr. Jim Doty, host of the Into the Magic Shop podcast. My guest today is Dr. B.J. Fogg. As many of you know, B.J. is the founder of the Behavior Design Lab at Stanford University, where he teaches behavior change and innovation. He's also the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Tiny Habits, The Small Changes That Change Everything. B.J. is going to share with us many of the insights which he's garnered over multiple decades in regard to persuasion technology and behavior change. And he also has an interesting formula which he has developed, which is B equals MAP, meaning that behavior change occurs when motivation, ability, and a prompt come together. Hopefully, B.J. will teach us how to change our own behaviors in such a way that those behavior changes stick. I hope you enjoy, and thanks for listening. B.J., it's great to have you with me today. I think we've met in person a few times, and I actually didn't realize we have the same literary agent.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Well, Doug and his team, they're awesome. Yes, I feel very lucky to have him. And yeah, we're like cousins or siblings, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And certainly I've been an admirer of your work for some time. I guess we've sort of seen each other from afar, maybe.
Yeah, I think we have a lot of mutual friends and students as well. So I'm so glad to be talking to you today. So thank you.
Well, you were mentioning earlier that you're in Maui. So are you on vacation or sabbatical or just having a good time?
No, we live here. We live here much of the time in Maui. It's wonderful. Great. Yeah. And there's a lot of things I can do remotely. There's some things that are more challenging, but all in all, living in Maui, we're here most of the time, frankly.
Wow, that's great. I lived in, on the big, or what am I saying? On,
Oahu.
Oahu.
Yeah.
I lived on Oahu for 4 years. I was in the military at Tripler, although the local attorneys called it Crippler. So, well, they had some biases, some self-interest biases. So what can you say? So one of the things I'm always interested in is actually people's backstory. You know, what was it about your own background that sort of led you to where you're at today? Because one, people's background, for good or bad, leave some sort of baggage that they carry with them. And it's great if it's mostly positive. Sometimes it's not always positive. But in your case, what events happened that made you interested? And I think you started out in sort of studying persuasive technologies versus behavior change. And we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Right. Yeah. Being a habits behavior change person, I think the roots go back to growing up Mormon. So I grew up in Central California in a large, very devout Mormon family. And a lot of that culture is about behavior change. It's about pray twice a day. It's about scripture study once a day. And it's about not doing things. No caffeine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was just kind of, I grew up very much with this emphasis, not only on behavior change, but optimizing your life. Steve Covey comes out of that tradition, Clay Christensen comes out of that tradition and more. So for me, something I grew up with. I remember as a kid, I was probably, 8, 9, or 10. Every year I would have sit down with my father in his office and it's like, what are your goals for this year? And it's like, so it was really just part of the system I grew up with. And as a good Mormon boy, I went on a mission to Peru, southern Peru, including Altiplano and also the Amazon rainforest. teaching people about Mormonism, but also what they call the welfare missionary, which is helping people cook healthier foods and things like that. You know, try as we might, naively, to help people. And that was all about behavior change, but also persuasion, frankly, you know. And so for me, it was pretty natural, especially because my dad was very forward-thinking in terms of technology and computers, to overlap those two areas. And I saw very early that computers, computing systems, would be used to change people's attitudes and behaviors. And that became kind of an obsession of mine in the early 90s. And after 10 years of being in Utah, trying to be a good Mormon boy as much as I could, I then went to Stanford for my PhD program to do experiments, social science experiments, specifically on the potentials of, and the problems, frankly, of using technology to influence thoughts, actions, and behaviors, and did a series of experiments there, which a lot of people didn't quite understand. They thought it was crazy. They thought, these are computers. They're not going to be used for this. And it's like, no, they will be used for this. And indeed they have, for better or for worse, and worse, I guess, not worse.
I was going to say that that's an interesting question. Well, maybe one of the places we can go is one of the things that I think people struggle with is actually changing behavior. And clearly, and whether it's a manifestation of entities outside of ourselves that have agendas such that we don't follow our best self-interest, which I think, frankly, is the case. What is, though, and maybe you can sort of explain it in a way that everyone can understand, we talk about persuasion and compare that to habit change, and how are they really different?
Yeah, two ways. And so my academic work was earlier on about persuasive technology, which we left behind. So my research lab at Stanford, we left that behind in 2010. And like, we did that, we warned people what was coming, we showed the potentials, we showed the problems, and then we moved to look at habits and behavior change. So in about 2010, and more formally in 2011, when we renamed the lab to be the Behavior Design Lab, we were done with the technology piece. What's the difference? Lots of them, but one of them is persuasion in some ways is getting people to do stuff they didn't intend to do necessarily. Maybe it, certainly not getting them to do things that are bad or dangerous, and that gets into some of the ethical challenges and things I've written about and taught about. Whereas when it comes to behavior change and especially habits, the only thing that really works in the long term is helping people do what they already want to do. And I have two maxims that summarize my work since 2010 or 11. And that's one of them is help people do what they already want to do, or help yourself do what you already want. So you're not persuading yourself. You are helping yourself do what you already want to do. So I think that's quite different than the notion of somebody's not intending to go to this fundraiser and you persuade them to go to the fundraiser, for example.
Well, maybe we'll get back to the persuasion part, but let's talk about the habit aspect of it. What are the major barriers, though? And again, you know, I sort of alluded to this idea of baggage that everyone carries, whether it's good baggage or bad baggage. And for many people who have a challenge with their behavior, you know, you contrast it with yourself, who grew up with clearly obvious positive reinforcement, I won't say correct, but behaviors that improved yourself and allowed you to create habits because of their consistency and because you were surrounded by a group of people who've followed various tenets or rules of which there was a positive aspect of it. Acting that way was a benefit. But it seems to me that so many people, and I probably on some level fall into this myself, is you fall back on things that have been sort of a comfort to you, but are not in your best interest, even though you know that, but it seems so difficult to overcome that.
Yeah. What are the key things there? There are many, but I'll talk about three and maybe a fourth for extra credit. Number one,
I'll give you extra credit, I promise. And you may
number
pass this, you may pass this
one. Yay.
podcast.
Okay. My work is really about helping people be happier and healthier and doing that through changing behavior in these positive ways. Number one, people are afraid to try again. So many people have tried and failed to change their behavior. And that's a problem right there. There's an employee wellness program. They don't want to sign up because the last one they signed up for that just made them look stupid, or they're at the bottom of the pack in the walking challenge. Okay. So it's like, I don't have the bandwidth. I don't have, or they've already blamed themselves. I don't know how to change, which is not true. So that's number one. It's just the track record of failure and people being afraid to try again. Number two, one thing that caused that is the old myths around how you change behavior. Most of the things that you see that are popularized are either not effective or not accurate. Okay, so the guidance we've been given to change our habits and our behaviors is largely wrong, which really opened the opportunity for the tiny habits method in my work, which is radically different. Number three, people in the moment, they can get over their fear and anxiety and want to change their behavior. They pick really big things to do, and that's a problem. If you pick something big and hard, that means you're going to have to rely on high levels of motivation. And what people don't account for generally, and certainly not in the moment, when they're deciding what they want to change, they're picking something very ambitious and big because in that moment, they're feeling the motivation. And in that moment, with motivation, they can do it. But what they don't understand, and this concept was never named until the last few years, where I and actually David Sobel there at medical school at Stanford, we named it the
Yeah, sure.
motivation wave. Your motivation goes up and down over time. When your motivation drops, and it will drop, you can no longer do the hard thing. So the third point is the problem with setting the bar too high and then somehow thinking magically you're going to keep your motivation high. The tiny habits method goes the opposite direction. You set the bar really low. So you focus on making it easy to do rather than trying to find kind of magical and unrealistic ways to keep your motivation high. And then the fourth extra credit point is the best way to go is really to focus on creating new habits rather than breaking or like talking about untangling unwanted behaviors. At least for the first phase of your behavior change journey, get really good at creating habits because the breaking or the unwinding of bad habits is a much more complicated task.
Well, maybe you could explain a little bit more about that complicated task and how it impedes you from the habit change, if you will, or discarding that habit.
The breakthrough, one of the breakthroughs in my work came in about 2007, where this model, the pieces fell together for me, and it goes, and I call it the fog behavior model. And it goes like this: a behavior happens when, and a habit is a type of behavior. A habit is a subset of a larger set of behaviors. So any behavior, including a habit, happens when you have motivation to do that. You have the ability to do it, and you have a prompt. Now, that applies to all behaviors and all cultures and all ages. So that is like this universal model, which at the time in 2007, I knew it was interesting and important, but I didn't realize how fundamental it would be to my work and to the tiny habits method and understanding behavior change. So when it comes, like let's say you want to stop a habit like, oh, drinking soda, for example. Well, you can stop a behavior if you can remove motivation, or if you can remove ability, or if you can remove the prompt. If you can turn any one of those into zero, like get rid of it, the behavior won't happen. So if you can remove the prompt, like, hey, I'm thirsty, have a soda now, like maybe you're prompting yourself or somebody offers you a soda, that's a prompt. Then if you have no prompts, you won't do the behavior. But many of these prompts, like drinking soda, are internal. They're urges that come up and go, oh, I'm really thirsty, or I'm feeling sluggish. Oh, time for a soda. Let me go to the motivation one. So it's the point there is hard to, for that kind of behavior, it's hard to cancel the prompt, turn off the prompt, etc. So then you look at motivation. If you could get rid of the motivation to drink soda, then you could stop. But over time, you've developed maybe a liking of soda, you're relying on the caffeine in the soda, and so on. So the motivation is there, and that's hard. So what you're really left with for many of these is the ability factor. Can you make it hard or impossible to do the behavior? And I'm fast forwarding. There's a whole system in my book, Tiny Habits. There's three pages that walk you through a flowchart, and there's a system. Boom, 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 boom. But this is kind of a quick example. So if you can make the soda drinking behavior very hard or impossible to do, then you have a pretty good chance of not drinking soda. So how do you do that? Well, one limited way is to say within our home, we're not bringing any sodas in the home. There's no sodas allowed in the home. And also, by the way, in my workplace, there's no sodas available. So you've made it harder to do. And that's often the only of motivation ability prompt with these kinds of behaviors. That's often the only thing that really you have under your control. And but people often try to work on the motivation piece or the prompt piece, and those are often not under our control.
So, and that's interesting, of course. There are some things that, you may say, well, I'm not going to have them. But as an example, soda, you may not have it in your office, you may not have it in your home. And then you are driving by a store or a fast food place, and you suddenly go, God, I'm really thirsty. And, you don't consciously think about that. But that suddenly diverts you, and you can't help but stop.
Yeah. And you're bringing up why, it's not a, so even though you can break it down to motivation ability prompt, you get into context where it's easy to get the soda. I have a great example of this. Driving home from Stanford, so this was, oh, I would say 5 to 7 years ago. I would teach once a week, a 3-hour class. I live up in, Sonoma County. So I'd be driving home. I'm pretty tired. And I love salty snacks. I love, love, love salty snacks. I don't care about sweets. I don't care about soda. I love, and I would drive by a gas station there on 19th in San Francisco, and I would stop off and buy a bag of chips. It was kind of like my reward for like, man, I've had a big day. So it's exactly the context that you're talking about. And it can be tricky because like part of you goes, nope, you're not stopping for chips. And another part of it is like, yep, you're stopping for chips. And another part of it says, well, I need gas. I'm going to stop. And then I'm not going to get chips. And then you're filling up with gas. And you're like, yeah, I'm going to go get the chips. Okay. So I couldn't redesign the gas station or the commuting home environment to make chips hard or impossible. But we certainly can do it in our home environment, for example. So it does end up being a more challenging thing. Whereas creating habits is pretty straightforward if you do it in a certain way.
Well, and are there any sort of counterintuitive things that you learn, though, in the context of studying the creation or getting rid of certain habits?
I developed the Tiny Habits Method in about 2010 because I was worried about my own health and well-being, and I really thought I was slipping. And I felt like at the time, let's see, how old would I be then? About 48. I'm 60 now. And I thought, well, if I don't change now, I won't be able to, which is totally not true, but that's what I felt. So I actually looked at my own behavior model, and there's a graphical version that has a curved line. And that curved line shows that there's a relationship between motivation and ability. And if you make a habit, and this, and I looked at my own graphic that I drew in Keynote, and I looked at
Well,
it.
you're pretty compulsive to do.
Well, I'm obsessed with behavior, right? And then I look at my own graphic and I was like, okay, if I make the habit really, really easy to do, according to my model and this graphic, I won't need high levels of motivation to do it. Motivation can be high or low. And I see that if I make it hard to do, I have to keep motivation high. So there's this relationship, it's a compensatory relationship between motivation and ability. The harder the behavior, the higher your motivation. The easier the behavior, the less you're reliant on motivation. So I was like, okay, I'm going to pick really easy habits. One drop of sunscreen, floss one tooth, two push-ups. So those don't take much motivation. And what happened is, as long as you figure out what's going to prompt the behavior, then you've accounted for all three things: motivation, ability, prompt. And as I played around in my own life with this method, I was able to create habits quickly and easily. Now, the surprise, and then I started teaching in 2011 in a 5-day program that still exists today, an email program where I was interacting with hundreds of people a week, and it added up to be thousands of people over the years, up to 60,000. That's when I stopped counting individually through email. So I was coaching. But it was about 2013, after 2 or 3 years of coaching people and habits, that I just saw the pattern in their comments where people's identity was shifting. It's like, oh, I, you know, even after 4 or 5 days, I now feel like I'm the kind of person who can change. I now see I'm the kind of person who can stick to things. So I added that to my assessment. You know, I'm a researcher and I'm always measuring and testing stuff. So I added that, and I saw that pretty clearly, that even within a handful of days and just with these tiny changes people made, a significant number of people would change their identity and embrace, like, I'm the person who can change. I'm the person who can improve my life, as opposed to I'm the person who always fails. I'm the person that, you know, lacks all this. And once, so that seems to come from feeling successful in change, and the size of the change doesn't need to be big. It could be floss one tooth, put on a drop of sunscreen. It's the feeling of success helped open people to that identity. Now, once they have that identity, my sense is, because I couldn't measure this directly, is then they would do other habits that were related to the new identity. So let's say I created habits around eating a healthy snack in the afternoon, a healthy snack, you know, after dinner. And so I was like, okay, I'm succeeding there. And I think of myself, I'm the kind of person who eats healthy snacks. Then when I'm driving by the gas station and I'm tired and I'm going home from Stanford through San Francisco, it's like, no, I'm not stopping because I'm the kind of person who eats healthy snacks. I'm not the kind of person who eats this crap out of the gas station. So it's the impact that even a tiny success in behavior change can have, leading to identity shift, which then seems to have a ripple effect on other behaviors you haven't even designed for.
Wow, that's... Now, that's interesting, because fundamentally, we're talking about a change of perception of yourself.
Right? Yeah.
But if you look at, as an example, hypnosis, does that have any impact, you think, on implanting a subconscious prompt in any way? Does that make sense?
I don't know. I hope so. I mean, I'm not an expert on hypnosis. I had a student that was in that arena. I don't know. I think maybe and possibly, I mean, we have different identities. We have a different, it's like we change hats, right? And so maybe hypnosis allows people to more fully embrace an identity that feels smaller, or they can embrace that in a larger context. I mean, in some contexts, I'm a teacher. In some contexts, I'm an uncle. In some contexts, I'm a husband. And that does affect your actions. And so having or being more able to embrace the identity, I'm the kind of person who eats healthy, or I'm the kind of person who can change, maybe hypnosis can help make that kind of identity more salient or more prevalent in someone's life. I don't know for sure, though.
No, I understand. It's just sort of fascinating, though, because in some ways, as you probably know, we have different programs for training people in self-compassion, which you know, decreases this narrative that you failed or you're not good enough or it's not possible. And although I haven't studied this in the sense of how it changes your habits, the mere fact that you are diminishing the negative voice in your head seems to have a very positive effect that can relate to improvement in choices.
Yes, yes. One of the big things, in fact, it's pretty early in the Tiny Habits book. Like, it's like, stop blaming yourself. It's not your fault. And I've gotten so many wonderful responses to that, because people really, when they follow these old myths and these old ways and they don't work, then they can't say, well, the method was wrong, because they assume it was right. Well, guess what? It was wrong. Are not very helpful anyway. So then they think, well, I'm a flawed person. So being nice to yourself, and, you know, in the quest to change, Either how you eat or how you use media, et cetera. Nobody's perfect in that quest. And one of the analogies or one of the things I, so we have a set of coaches that we've trained in Tiny Habits, and they certainly try to equip them as much as possible. And one of them is, when it comes to behavior change, most people are like little babies learning to walk. And so help your, and we call them habiteers, people that are working on habits. So the coaches are working with habiteers. Help your habiteers, even though they might be really successful in business or really successful, whatever. When it comes to behavior change, this is new to you. And you're like a baby learning to walk. And that means you're going to stumble. That means you're going to tumble. And that's okay. What do you do when a baby stumbles and tumbles? You don't say you're a failure, you lack willpower, you lack discipline. You just, you cheer it on and you get back up. And so that has been helpful for some people to say, oh, okay. So the stumbling and the tumbling on this path is normal and it's okay. And, you know, it goes back one of the myths, like the black and white thinking, like I have to be perfect. Nobody's perfect in this quest. You learn from those stumbles and tumbles and you move on. And so self-compassion, and often I just talk about just be nice to yourself, is so important for people to get. And it really does help open them up to continue on the path to change and to go after changes in their life they might have been afraid to do before.
It's interesting. I've run across some individuals, actually some of them at Stanford, who are these incredibly intense, highly disciplined, highly motivated individuals who seemingly do everything correctly, but sometimes being around them is hard because it's sort of my way or the highway. Do you have any insights or thoughts on that?
Here's what I tell my Stanford students. Here's what I tell them.
I like that. I like that exhale.
Well, here's what I tell them. It's like, okay, there's certain things you were able to do that got you into Stanford. You were able to cram, you were able to be good at tests, you were able to impress people that wrote good letters, et cetera. But when it comes to behavior change, you're just like everybody else in the world. You are not special. So don't expect yourself to be special. You were special in high school where you didn't study for the exam. You skimmed the chapter in 15 minutes and you aced the test. Yes, I get it. But that's not how behavior change works. So reset your expectations about who you are and how it won't be supernatural for you or super easy like acing tests. That's not exactly your question, but I think it's helpful for my students to understand that that their gifts that got them into Stanford may not be or not the same gifts that will help them change their behavior in these positive ways. In fact, in my more recent classes, I'm asking them to unwind some of those obsessions. I'm asking them to focus on relationships and creating strong relationships. That's my focus over the last few years and moving forward is creating habits and practices that strengthen your most important relationships. And I just sometimes warn my students, your parents are not going to like me for saying this, but it's a better investment at Stanford for you to focus on building strong relationships. Figure out who do you want to work with for decades to come rather than what score you're going to get in the physics test. Your parents are not going to like me, but this is the reality. The opportunity here is to build strong relationships, figure out who you want to collaborate with, and that's the value you get out of Stanford, not necessarily that you got an A on the physics test.
No, I appreciate that. Now, you know, I think that sort of deviated slightly from the question because you mentioned obsession. So what I'm trying to get at is there's, and maybe this may not be the right thing to ask at all, but there is a subset of people who, if you want to say, have absolutely embraced habit change to the point where they're very rigid and fixated on their goals and tasks that limit them from actually oftentimes interacting with the rest of the world. Now, as an example, I have a few friends who, you know, well, I'm doing this at this time. I never deviate from that. Or I have to do this. And in fact, they have this, you know, schedule that cannot under any circumstances, whether it's their partner, whether it's their friend, whether it's anybody, I do this and that's just the way it is. Do you think that's healthy? I mean, it seems like they've mastered this incredible discipline. They've mastered habit, creation of habits. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, like I said earlier, my focus is really helping people be happier and healthier. And behavior change and habits is part of that. Somebody who's so rigid like that, I really wonder if they're happy. So they might be getting A's. They might be getting the great internships. They might be getting the great job and making tons of money. But are they really happy? The way I think about it, I think of it as a balance. There's certain things that you want to routinize. There's certain things you want to have reliable habits for. And then there's parts of your life where you want to be open to spontaneity, to discovery, to serendipity. And I think everybody has a little bit of a different balance of what that looks like. For me, and it's kind of odd, I mean, if you set aside the Mormon context, kind of odd that I'm a habits guy because I'm like an improviser. I always never want to do things the same way. I'm really driven to always do something different and new. So for me, habit formation and understanding habits wasn't, I mean, yes, culturally wired into me, but you know, my personal disposition is how do I do this differently and let me take a different path and so on. So I like a lot of spontaneity in my life. The people who are just completely like, here's what I do at every moment, I just really don't think, maybe some of them, I just really question whether at the end of the day they're happy or whether they're emotionally healthy.
No, I totally agree with you. You know, one example is, and I won't name his name, but you, I'm sure, know who it is. There's this fellow who is spending a lot of money every year on longevity. Mm-hmm. And he has this absolutely rigid, I only eat at this time, I exercise from this time, I monitor my number of erections. And you sit there and you look at him and you're going, and he takes, you know, 122 supplements. He, I think his diet is 1,997 calories a day. And you sit there and you go, wow, is that really living? And now, again, I'm not him and I don't have, you know, insight into what he's thinking. And maybe it's so divergent from how I think, but yeah, I mean, that's what I question. Are these types of people happy? Have they talked themselves into being happy? Or maybe you and I don't know what we're talking about.
Well, I think for me and you both, that would not be a happy existence. The thing, and this came about 2 or 3 years into coaching people in the Tiny Habits Method, like through the email, I'm sitting there. Even before we owned a place here in Maui, I'm sitting on the balcony in Maui, not on the beach, and I'm doing, you know, coaching people in habits, like a lot, like hundreds of people every day. And one guy got back to me, and it was a man, who said, oh my gosh, now that I know how to create habits, the question becomes, what habits should I create? And I was like, oh, you're right. And I said, I don't have the wisdom. I can tell you, I can teach you the method, and you know, this is breakthrough and you create habits. But who am I to say what habits you should create? And that's kind of my answer to your question. Who am I to say what the right balance is between habits and spontaneity and so on? The good news is that being able to create habits quickly and easily is now available. But then there's this what habits to form and what habits to let go. That's part of the overall system, is when habits stop serving you. I'm not even talking bad habits. It might have been a good habit at a certain point, but it stopped serving you. And part of what the Tiny Habits coaches and I help people understand is when a habit has served its purpose, great, let it go. And either leave that space open or use that space for some other habit that is meaningful and important to you at this point. So, but that's everybody's, you know, I almost never tell people what habits to actually create. And this year, my younger brother texted me and said, hey, tell me what habits I should do. Because, you know, Tiny Habits, like, here's this method, apply it however you want. There's tons of examples, but I don't prescribe the habits. But then I thought, for my brother, I will. And I boiled it down to this tidiness habit, strength training habit, all very, very simple, and relationships. And I shared that in a little chat and people loved it. And so I put it out to my email list and it was very, very popular. So I thought, well, maybe I should have been prescribing habits to people, but I still don't want to go there. I don't want to pretend like I know what are the best habits for everybody. But I was pretty confident in that case that this daily habit of tidying one thing, that strength training, not to exhaustion, but some strength training on a regular basis is important. And certainly habits that will strengthen your relationships. I knew, or I feel very strongly, that those benefit everybody.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. I had Bob Waldinger on the show recently, who, as you know, directs the Harvard Longevity Study. And just to mention what you've just said, how you live the longest, how you are healthy, actually is due to the strength of your relationships and the depth of your connections. And it's interesting how, you know, there are a million cookbooks on the Mediterranean diet, but by far and away, the most important aspect of that work is the reality that it is indeed depth of connections and depth of relationships that actually are the most powerful in creating a, if you will, a happy life.
And I had a sense of that back in 2004. I did a startup that was about strengthening relationships, and the technology wasn't quite there, and we made a whole bunch of mistakes, of course, as you do in startups. But I look back now and I was like, yeah, I was concerned about that. I don't think I'm naturally good at relationships, but I think I somehow understood back then more intuitively. Now, fast forward, within the School of Medicine at the Stanford Lifestyle Medicine Group, I'm in the social engagement pillar and heading some of the efforts there. So it's bringing the behavior change and habit expertise as applied to social engagement. The way I think about that isn't like a big network. It's, you know, what we're talking about here. It's like, how do you strengthen your most important relationships? So that right now is bullseye for my work and my classes at Stanford and part of what I'm doing outside of Stanford. And it's really interesting and it's really fun. And you're right, there's not that much guidance on it. There are some really great people out there, but we can do better. And so it does feel like there's room to blaze new trails and help people. So I'm always obsessed with what's the simplest thing that will give the biggest result. And I'm going to share one right now. I probably shouldn't share it, but I will.
No, please.
So yeah, this year with my Tiny Habits coaches, so I train them once a month and I do office hours with them and so on. And this year, the theme of my training is help people feel successful. Okay. That matters for habits and it's one of my maxims, et cetera. And so all of my trainings are that. And the one we did a couple weeks ago is in dyadic conversations, talking with another person, what's the simplest way to build that relationship? And what I put out to my Tiny Habits coaches, and then I come back in 2 weeks, and we're going to hear what happened, and then we're going to build on that, is what I challenge them to do is just use two words. As you're talking to somebody and they make a statement, say, you're right. And stop there. You're right. And stop. And see what happens to your husband, your wife, your child, etc. Just say, you're right. And I won't go into why I think that's super powerful, but it's like one of the very simple things you can do to strengthen relationships. In the next training I'll do, we'll follow up. Some of them have already reported some of their results and, you know, qualitative results. The next one will be, how do you help people feel successful? So if somebody shares a success with you, and too often people one-up you, or they make a joke of it, or they dismiss it. So I've categorized all the wrong ways to respond when somebody shares a success. And here are the better ways to respond. I did it with my husband just about before we started the podcast. He came home from the dentist. He said, the dentist says, I look great. I said, wow, that's wonderful. How do you feel about that? So I let him bask in that feeling of success and let him go further with sharing that with me. That strengthened our relationship. It's that simple sometimes.
It's interesting you say that because, as you well know, you'll say, what was the statement? You're right. But so
You're right.
often people put the next statement, which is but.
You're right, full stop. We'll see. I hesitate to share because I haven't done quantitative research. I haven't done an experiment. It's just my sense of things. And it's fun to involve others in it and hear what they say. And if it looks like it has promise, we'll do something more systematic and rigorous. But imagine if just saying you're right and stopping there can take a mediocre marriage and turn it into something quite special. Maybe give it a shot, y'all.
Yeah, no, I think that's really quite fascinating. The other thing you mentioned related to this is this idea of dyadic conversations. A lot of people don't appreciate how powerful that is. We've done a bit of work in that area, and there are a number of others. But engaging with somebody where you have a conversation, and you pointed out it shouldn't be a one-upsmanship. It shouldn't have any negative connotation. In some ways, it's actually an exercise in listening without interruption and offering support.
And compassion. You're right. I'll stop there, but I'll build on that because one of the
I
things
like
that
that.
I
You said you're
previous
right. You're right. I feel bad.
and I'll just stop and we're closer. I'll group hug on Zoom. Here we go. It's and this is a habit. This is a harder habit, and I'm trying to really train myself. When somebody is talking to me and they say something, especially if they share a success, think, what is this person needing from me or wanting from me? And then giving it to them. I mean, you've got to be genuine. I'm not like in a manipulative way. And sometimes it's just so easy to give it, rather than, having a conflict or one-upsmanship or whatever, why not try to understand what that person is wanting from you from that statement and then just give it to them generously?
Well, that's very true. I think that people forget actually how easy it is to give people a positive statement of encouragement or simply, as my coffee cup says, be kind. And and you wonder about that because now, I want to preface this by saying I'm certainly not perfect, but in my interactions, I try to leave that as, either, listen, you're doing really a great job here, or thank you so much. I very much appreciate it. You're really cool. You're really special. And the power of that and is so great that in some ways it's like giving them a free habit. Or does that make sense at all, where you're giving them something that they can sort of hold that gives them the strength to go to that next level?
I'm nodding my head vigorously. I'm holding back the you're right because I made that joke once, but you are absolutely right. Especially now, people are depressed, they're discouraged, they have a lot of anxiety. And this is what the tiny habits from the beginning was all about. My sister joined me early on, and our coaches. It's about giving people hope. We don't care what habits you form. We don't care really. I mean, flossing's good and strength training's good. But if you can give people hope, which can help combat the fear and the anxiety and maybe to some extent depression and so on, that's like the best thing you can do. And so that's really central to my work is how do you make that? How do you help people create habits that give them hope? And the fact that they see they can change, of course, that gives them hope. Was the first measure I did in the Tiny Habits program from the beginning, from the question one always, since 2011, was about that sense of hope that they had that they could improve their lives. But yeah, and in a simple dyadic conversation, even with a stranger, like I was with my husband, Obviously, I'm not a good Mormon boy anymore. I've been with my husband 30 years. He was also Mormon. But we, I know, so there's more to that story, but we knew it for years.
Well, and it's interesting you say that because it's how you embed I wasn't good based on this prior baggage that you were.
Well, it's you know what? I mean, I'll go to the grocery store store, but let me. I think part of it is people will stereotype, oh, we grew up Mormon, therefore this and this and this. And yeah, I tried really hard. It just didn't work for me. I mean, I didn't really discover I was gay until I was in my 20s. I was at Brigham Young. I was completely, completely frightened. I was terrified that I'd be discovered and kicked out. It was really traumatic.
Oh, well,
Fast
sure.
forward. I was at a little health food grocery store that I shop at a lot, and my husband doesn't so much. And we're checking out, we're buying some stuff. And the checker said, oh, we brought our bags. And I said, oh, yeah, we'll bag our own. But I said, Denny, what you need to know is she is the best person to arrange things in bags, like in all of South Maui. And she just beamed. Okay, so I gave her this compliment, and it was easy and free to do. I had no ulterior motivation to do it, but I
And you
knew that
believed it.
because the couple, oh, totally believed it, right? My thing is you have to be authentic. You can't just.
Yeah, exactly.
She, a couple months ago, said, oh, let me bag your bags. And she was very careful about it. And so I knew that mattered to her. Okay, so when you praise people, everybody loves praise, but it's especially on things that matter to them. And I knew that that mattered to her, that she was really good at bagging stuff. And so it was just like one simple sentence, and maybe she went home and told her family about it. It's that easy sometimes. And it's just, part of my hope in talking to you and the audience here is that people say, yeah, it's so easy to do, and it doesn't cost me anything, and it makes me feel great, and I can be authentic. Why not develop those habits?
No, I think that's a really important statement to make. And again, preface this by the word authentic. But again, so often in my own experience, I've given somebody a compliment or sometimes just shared a smile, and you see them a period of time later and they remember it. And it's again, I think something really, really to remember that, how you connect with somebody, how you interact with somebody can result in a deep set memory. But that memory hopefully is good, but sometimes negative acts can also embed a memory, which is really horrible. It can be devastating to somebody. And this is where I think people forget that words matter.
A lot. And just kind of summarize what we've been talking about, at least from my perspective. So my focus and bullseye to my work, yeah, it's behavior change and habits and et cetera. But it's habits of strengthening relationships by helping other people feel successful. So there's different ways to strengthen relationships. So what I'm on this year, because it's all about helping people feel successful, both in the real world and research, is how can you strengthen relationships by creating these habits of helping others feel successful. And that's super exciting, and it's fun, and it makes you kind of happy to do it, to be frank.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any question that having that as a life purpose is the fundamental aspect of actually true happiness. It's purpose, it's meaning. It's not, I bought a new house or a new car and look what I have. And that's the sad statement, I think, sometimes related to the Western capitalist narrative.
And how we extract ourselves from that, I'm not an expert on. I think your work, the guests you talk with, and so on are helping us. And because you bring that audience together, I was delighted when you invited me on your podcast because you and the people I imagine that are listening to this are the people that are on that path and trying to make the world a better place in these positive ways.
No, and I really appreciate you coming on, and I just do want to end this by saying your work is very, very important. It's one that's influenced hundreds of thousands of people, And I think it's important to acknowledge that and also indicate that there's so many people who either want to be or are on that path, and acknowledging how important that is, because that does, in fact, move the needle, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I really thank you. It's a great opportunity to share, and great questions.
Well, BJ, I hope that we have the opportunity, maybe when you're back one of these days, to actually have a coffee or share a meal, because I'd really like to connect with you a little bit more. And actually, I have a couple other personal questions that we can chat at another time about. So I appreciate you being on the show, and thank you so much. Again, thank you for being with us today. The Into the Magic Shop podcast can be found where you find your most popular podcasts, or you can find us at intothemagicshop.com.